Best podcast audience. I'm happy to be speaking with you again today. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Rob Rothman. I am a clinically practicing ophthalmologist. I am a glaucoma specialist by training, and I spend about 50% of my time in clinical care treating complicated and referral glaucoma patients. The remainder of my time is spent managing InFocus Capital Partners, which is an ophthalmology-specific venture capital fund. We have closed our first fund, have 12 assets which are moving through the clinical process very well. And then we have just begun the launch of our capital raising efforts for Fund 2. Having said that, today I have a very exciting guest for me personally, and hopefully for the audience. It is the interview that almost never was. But today we have Malvina Edelman as a guest. And for those of you who don't know Malvina, you probably have nothing to do with ophthalmology. If you have anything to do with ophthalmology, then you know who Malvina is. But potentially unknown factoid is that Malvina is a board-certified ophthalmologist. And the reason that I can vouch for the fact that she is a board-certified ophthalmologist is that Malvina and I actually trained together. So that into the mid-1990s. When we were in training together, Malvina was a senior resident when I was a first-year resident. But more importantly, as of late, she is the director of the FDA's Office of Ophthalmic Anesthesia, Respiratory, ENT, and Dental Devices. And she has recently become an adjunct clinical professor at Stanford University in the Department of Ophthalmology, which is a new thing we'll talk about as we get through it. But for the general ophthalmic investing community, Malvina is the top of the FDA food pyramid for a lot of what goes on in ophthalmology. So we all know Malvina. She's a perennial and continuous figure at all of the important ophthalmology business meetings, which is very germane to this podcast and to the audience for this group. And Malvina, thank you for making the time, although I know it was a giant pain in the neck for you. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin. I'm really, really glad we're finally connecting.
Well, it's funny, you know, because look, I mean, I would say, I mean, I probably even know you longer than just about anybody who knows you in ophthalmology these days, right? I mean, I kind of knew you when you were just a little kid. I mean, you right? I mean, isn't that true?
I'm still a little kid at heart.
Yeah. I know, but back in the day, I mean, I get a little credit for having some innate knowledge of Malvina as a person. But I, you know, as we spoke before and as we've spoken many times over the past however many years, I think the story of your journey through this career path is kind of interesting and a little bit unique, right? How many people become the director of an FDA office, especially one in which they're specialized in training? It's not a very common scenario. So I thought it would be interesting for people who listen to kind of get a little bit of sense as to how this came about, kind of where it started, how you made the decision to do this. Like, go back to the beginning in terms of where you grew up, all the educational stuff, and then we'll get into the pivot from, you know, being a clinical ophthalmologist into, you know, an FDA leader.
Well, thanks, Rob. So I was born in the country of Georgia in a family of academicians. Both of my parents were professors in medical school. My mom was a professor of linguistics and communications, and my dad was a professor of biotechnology and ran a very large cybernetics lab. And he's the one who instilled in me this passion for innovation very, very early in my life. You know, many little girls grow up with bedtime stories about beautiful princesses. Well, my bedtime stories usually began the same way as normal, with once upon a time. However, instead of beautiful princesses, they centered on magic machines that learned how to cure the sick. My dad, every night, would make up a different fascinating story about futuristic medical advances that truly challenged my imagination. And, you know, as I got a little older, I knew I wanted to follow in my dad's footsteps and bring some of these stories from fairy tale into reality. In pursuit of my dream, I started by studying electrical and biomedical engineering at the Cooper Union. And then, having obtained a solid science and engineering background, I wanted to study medicine But I wanted to study it in a way that would enable me to combine the science, the medicine, engineering to maximize my potential as a clinician scientist. Because my goal always was to translate research into clinical practice. So I chose to pursue the next step of my education at Harvard MIT Health Science and Technology program. It's a very unique, fantastic program that really gave me a wonderful foundation. And then during clinical rotations at Harvard, I fell in love with ophthalmology and decided to do my MIT thesis in ophthalmic space. My thesis resulted in a patent for new ophthalmic technology, and I became convinced that I wanted to continue honing my ophthalmic knowledge to pursue ophthalmology residency, where we had the pleasure of meeting. And as I was finishing my residency, just like everybody else, well, most people, I was deciding between a career in academia versus private practice. And all of a sudden, in those days, it was still, you know, hard copy journals, not online. And in those days, and I opened...
Nice. Thanks for reminding me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I figured we'll admit how old we are.
No. No, don't do it.
And I opened up the blue journal and, you know, I see an ad for ophthalmic medical officer at FDA Center of Devices and Radiological Health. And at that time, I had no idea anything about FDA, but I decided to take a look into that black box, which was FDA for me at the time. It was a big black box. So I did a little research and I realized that most of everything we do in our daily practices as ophthalmologists is dependent on devices which are regulated by FDA. So after significant soul searching, I concluded that I wanted to maximize my impact, benefiting as many patients as I could. And I accepted the offer to come work for the government. And that started my career at the FDA.
Let me interrupt for a second. So you had, during medical school was when you really kind of had some work that you were doing at MIT, right? It was kind of a combination for you in terms of science-based research and medical education, which I think is not typical. You know, I mean, at least for, not for me. I mean, for my medical school education, there was always, the story was do some research because it'll help you get a residency, like do something and something you like because maybe it'll help. You know what I mean? It was kind of like a means to an end type of thing.
Yeah, that's not
yours. That's not wasn't your path. You did it a little bit.
No. Right. I mean, I started out wanting to be a clinician scientist, wanting to take basic and engineering science and translate it into clinical practice, basically translate my dad's fairy tales into reality. That was all.
So you had some motivation, right? So you always thought that maybe there was a chance that you weren't going to end up in an office seeing patients somewhere.
No, I was truly, I mean, when I was interviewing for all MD, PhD programs because I knew I wanted to combine the two. So I always wanted to be a clinician scientist. And that's why I chose HST, which is, for those of you who don't know, it's a very, very unique program. So for example, when we were, everybody in that program has extremely strong science background. So for example, when we were studying cardiology, cardiac physiology, it was explained through electric circuits, which I'm sure was very different than how you learned cardiology,
yeah,
cardiac physiology. So, you know, it was a very small class. We had less than 30 people in the class in HST, and everybody had extremely strong science or engineering background, and everybody wanted to pursue to become a clinician scientist.
Okay. So there was always that background there. So then you finish your training, and then it's 1995, right? I think it was when you were done, right? 95?
Yeah.
So then you go right into the FDA. What do you do at the FDA when you get there? What's the job for you? You're an MD, you know, PhD, you've got this science background, you've got clinical ophthalmic training. So what do they do with you?
So I like to think about it as decades.
Okay.
So I started out as a medical officer, and then I became the senior medical advisor.
What's a medical officer? As a medical officer. Why? What is a medical? I mean, I deal with you as you now. I don't know what the people who, you know, what does a medical officer at the FDA do? I don't know.
Medical officer at the FDA is a person who reviews the submissions and makes recommendations about both clinical investigations and makes the recommendations for marketing approval.
Okay, so you had some experience there because having done MD, PhD, you had a science background. Like, it would be hard for me, as an example, to have come out of a residency program and said, I want to go work with the FDA and have any idea what I was reading, having the non-scientific background, correct? Like, not everybody can just pop out of residency and say, I want to go work at the FDA and become a medical officer. Is that true?
So I definitely had a niche, a very unique niche that made it extremely easy and made it a fluid transition, because every review team for every device is, we have people from all different backgrounds, and then everybody comes together to assess the application and make recommendations. So it's certainly a lot easier if you understand the technology and the science and the engineering. Having said that, since as I went through many decades at FDA, I have recruited and hired many medical officers who have not had an engineering background, and they are trainable. It's not like it's impossible to train them, but I have had quite a number who have had engineering or science as a first undergraduate degree, and usually the transition is a lot easier.
Gotcha. Well, I've been told I'm untrainable, so it's a good thing I didn't work for the FDA. So that's a good thing. Okay, so you're a medical officer, then you become a senior medical advisor, and then what happens?
So in the first decade, as I got there, so I had the privilege to work on many first-of-a-kind ophthalmic devices. I was, for a while, I was the only ophthalmic medical officer, and as a result, I ended up working on every single ophthalmic device that ever went through the FDA. So I probably have broader experience than any of the subsequent medical officers, just because it was the way things worked out.
Well, it was only like two or three, so it couldn't have been that hard, right? It's like two or three things you looked at,
right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's like two or three. Okay,
So I did a lot of first-of-a-kind devices as a medical advisor. Then we hired more people, but then as I became senior medical advisors, the most complicated, the first-of-a-kind submissions came to me. So like LASIK, for example, I did the reviews of the first LASIK devices. But the other aspect that I think was very unique is I wanted to make sure nobody else thinks of FDA as a black box. So I spent a significant amount of time changing the paradigm and trying to provide clarity to the ophthalmic community about FDA's role. So I started giving talks at the professional meetings, wrote publications for a while, had time, and ran a column at INAT about, different aspects of FDA. And then I also became an FDA expert to American National Standards Institute. And subsequently, I was selected as a U.S. representative to the International Standards Organization. So now this is not FDA, this is for the whole United States. And as a result, that was an incredible, incredible experience that I have been doing for decades, because that truly honed my communications and negotiation skills. I got to work with every regulatory body around the world and try to figure out where the problems are, where we need to develop novel endpoints versus where there's just miscommunication.
Can you just, sorry to interrupt, but can you just, I know what ANSI is because of my investments in the device space, but can you tell people what that entity is responsible for? Because it's kind of important.
Right. So both American National Standards Institute and International Standards Organization generate standards that can then be recognized by different regulatory bodies around the world as recommendations for how to conduct assessments of novel medical devices. So in ophthalmology, we have done, we have probably more recognized standards. So then FDA can look at the different standards and decide whether they want to recognize a particular standard or not. And then we have a web page that lists all of the recognized standards. And then the standards, both ANSI and ISO, are built in, they have a horizontal and a vertical. So horizontal is just going to talk about, how do you, for example, how do you conduct clinical investigations? And then the vertical standard is going to talk about the particular kind of a device, for example, IOL, accommodating IOL, toric IOL, you know, et cetera. So it is an incredibly powerful way to create consensus around the globe, especially with ISO.
Right.
Because then, you know, you have the same requirements, the same recommendations for carrying out. Now, when a sponsor comes in to a regulatory body and is utilizing a recognized standard, they don't have to provide justification for their approach. You know, they can just say, this has been testing according to ISO XXY, and you, Australia, for example, have decided that you recognize this, so therefore I do not need to tell you why that's valid.
So for device, so for device people out there, if you have, you have to be ISO certified, right? I mean, it's got the ISO certification process, or the ANSI certification process, kind of allows you to actually produce your product. I mean, it's, it covers the standard.
Or you can go to a lab.
Right, go to a lab. But the international recognized for standardization of a lot of the things that go into medical devices comes from ANSI and ISO. I mean, everybody knows the term ISO certification.
Right. Now, the unique thing that we did in ophthalmic standards that is really not copied in that many other fields is that we created annexes and delineated recommendations for clinical investigations. So a lot of the vertical standards, like, for example, for IOL, if you pick up a thing for a you pick up a standard for accommodating IOL, it's going to tell you, in order to study a new accommodating IOL, we recommend this as a key. These are the key foundational blocks for you to conduct clinical trial. So it's, you know, and I have spent a lot of hours on this over my life, but I'm really happy to say that we now have over 60 recognized standards just for ophthalmic medical devices.
Yep. I'm aware of those. It's actually, to be honest with you, I think it makes the process a lot easier for people looking in the device space to know exactly what they have to do. So it's been a big help for people looking in the device space. There's no ambiguity as to what you need to do in order to become, you know, an approvable product. But okay, so sorry to take you off course there, but so you're the director of ophthalmology and ENT, and then kind of bigger, right? So your job gets bigger after that. Like, you didn't have enough to do, I guess.
So in 2006, I became the director of the division, and that role allowed me to lead and direct ophthalmology a little bit greater than I could in my previous role. So I sort of chose what are the biggest hurdles I wanted to attack. And one of the things that I'm very proud of is all of the collaborative efforts over the years that ophthalmology has done. I believe that successful innovation can only occur when we integrate different perspectives and expertise from all of the different stakeholders in the medical device ecosystem. And so my group has led many, many collaborative workshops to address key challenges in ophthalmic innovation over the years. And we can talk about them now. We can keep going. For example, the one that you probably know is the MIGS workshop as a glaucoma person, you know, so for example, partnered with AGS, and then the input provided from that workshop led to the first FDA's leapfrog guidance for MIGS devices, and then subsequent approval for quite a number of MIGS devices. Another good example that I think many people can relate to is the workshop we did with AAO on premium IOLs. That's where we generated the first ever regulatory definition for EDOF, extended depth of focus, and then subsequent formed a task force with AAO and then published key papers, consensus documents for all of the premium IOLs. The other one that I'll just do one. There's a very long list. Don't worry, I'm not going to go through all of it. Just another one that I think is important to highlight is the ophthalmic digital health workshop, where we put together six different organizations, and that allowed us to elucidate a number of key digital health issues. And shortly thereafter, we were able to grant the first ever artificial intelligence device that's capable of diagnosing without physician input. So again,
that was IDX, right?
Right. So IDX wasn't just the first for ophthalmology, it was the first for FDA. So it was quite an accomplishment.
That's great. Look, everybody who is involved in any way with product development in ophthalmology is aware of all these workshops and all of these opportunities, but it appears as though that was not quite enough of a job for you, right? Because you needed to have something added to your pile a few years later. Is that not correct?
Yeah.
Since 2009, they added something else to you. How does neurology come into the mix?
No good deed goes unpunished. But I'll spare you all the different steps, but, in addition to ophthalmology over the years, my oversight included neurosurgery, neurology, psychiatry, ENT, anesthesia, respiratory, sleep medicine, and dentistry. So quite a large portfolio.
So how many people do you have working underneath you to handle all this stuff? Because, you have a general background, but I'm sure that you need experts in anesthesia and dental and psychiatry and all these other things to help you. So what's the size of the team now?
So right now, my office has three divisions. Right. The first division is ophthalmology.
Which is the most important?
Of course.
Just making sure.
And then the second division is ENT and dental. And the third division is respiratory anesthesia and sleep devices. So right now, my office is about 150 people. But, what I need to point out is that previously, before 2019, my responsibilities were just in the pre-market space. In other words, I was only involved in clinical trials and deciding what goes on the market. And then in 2019, the Center for Devices and Radiological Health underwent this major reorganization that we call Total Product Lifecycle Reorganization. And essentially, we consolidated and integrated pre-market compliance and post-market surveillance functions into a new team-based approach. So my office right now, my Office of Health Technology, is responsible for oversight of the total product lifecycle for the devices under my purview. So it's not just pre-market.
So as an example, let me just use one that's familiar to me. So like CyPass, for example, right? So there's an example of a device that, was approved by the FDA, but then subsequently was identified as having an issue. That was all under your purview. Okay, so that got busy.
There's a significant advantage to that because, I have the same people who are surveilling literature and looking at the medical device reporting and looking at the safety and looking at the signals to determine if there's safety or not. And under my office, I also have a very large compliance arm. So that, when things don't go well, we come out and say, sorry.
Oops. So I know there's a story here, so I just think it would be important to touch upon. So you mentioned respiratory. So what happened, because this happened right before COVID, right? This was 2019. So you get, respiratory, which you're like, oh, that's going to be a softball, right? I don't know how much respiratory, issue do we have? And then, boom, you have COVID. So how does that, what do you do with that? I mean, I'm sure there was a whole issue regarding respirators and all this other stuff. What happened to you during COVID?
Yeah. So unfortunately, COVID hit within 6 months of my accepting this position. And I was faced with the greatest challenge of my professional career. I was responsible for total oversight of all of the ventilators. And as there was a great need for ventilators and other respiratory devices that outpaced the supply available. So my team and I had to figure out how to address this ventilatory, this crisis. For my team, it became an all-hands-on-deck response, and we proactively assessed and began modifying policies to help expand the supply of ventilators. First, we issued a regulatory policy that said that FDA would not object to manufacturers marketing certain modifications to ventilators and supporting accessories without first submitting changes to the FDA for evaluation. The policy also permitted healthcare professionals to use alternative devices capable of delivering breaths or pressure support, which was very important at the time. Our message essentially was that FDA is going to work with you to remove every possible barrier to help expand production of ventilators. Now, the other thing that made it extremely complicated is that my team and I had to leverage something called EUA, Emergency Use Authorization Pathway. And that's a very unique legal authority that only is viable during certain national emergencies to encourage and streamline the introduction of, to address the public health emergency. The problem was that none of us have ever used it, have ever seen it, since we were lucky enough not to have lived through it. This was the first pandemic for all of us. Not only that, but there was no SOP for how to use this regulation. So, we were building the plane and flying it basically at the same time. So we had to figure out SOP as ASAP. And then we had to figure out how to train ourselves on all of these new processes and figure out totally new workflow to survive. My team, in addition to this, my team provided guidance and support to both traditional and non-traditional manufacturers, which it was very unique because, as you remember, there were car manufacturers, so people who have no idea what devices are. And so all of a sudden, in addition to providing usual guidance to people who know what medical devices are, we were in a position to start to try to communicate to non-traditional manufacturers how to expeditiously bring life-saving ventilators to market. There was a tremendous amount of work, and we had to design a brand new and efficient system to track this voluminous external inquiries. All of this work was in addition to our normal workload. Most people during COVID sat at home and generated new ideas and new submissions about new innovative ideas. Now, all of those came in addition to our ventilatory work. And to deal with this incredible amount of work, we created a virtual war room. And we had to meet there twice a day, every day, to plan and organize our response. We had to communicate our progress and plans to our leadership 3 times a day, 7 days a week. So there was no downtime. The amount of work that my team did was so overwhelming. And, we're dealing with COVID and as individuals, in addition to working 24/7. And during that time, even though I didn't have much sleep, because none of us took vacation for more than a year, my whole team, there was no weekends, there was no vacation. We were just on 24/7. We just, it was back like being an intern. Forget about the residency. It was
ICU. It was ICU time.
It was an ICU for a year, basically. The first year was just like that.
Which for ophthalmology residents, by the way, means hell. right? ICU equals hell. It's like, I'm going to be operating on people's eyes, and putting in central lines is not in my future plans. So you are in the ICU of the FDA. I get it.
Yeah. And, you know, during that time, I had to figure out how not only think outside the box, but how to evolve essentially from being an engaging and enabling leader to become an inspirational leader to provide that kind of a support to my team. I had to really think outside the box. So the few hours that I wasn't working, I started taking classes at MIT Sloan School of Management to try to figure this out. And they were wonderful. In those days, they were all virtual, so I didn't have to leave my office. And I found the classes to be so impactful that I continued and ended up in 2022 getting an advanced certificate for executives in management, innovation, and technology. And I think that really gave me that was a fantastic experience. And but back to COVID, I'm really, really proud of my team's response to this crisis. It has been unprecedented in terms of volume, speed, and agility. And I was truly humbled when my contribution was acknowledged by a personally signed letter of appreciation from the president.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would agree. I think a lot of people should send you signed letters. I mean, I think that the policies that you enacted allowed for the rapid production of, you know, life-saving medical technology. It's not easy to change, you know, a regulatory environment in Washington. And this was a true kind of wartime response, right? I mean, this is what happens. I remember there were refrigerator manufacturers making, you know, ventilators, right? I mean, that was the story. It was that whoever could make something, you know, who had electronic and mechanical capacity to build ventilators should start making ventilators.
Yeah, we had about, I don't think we have enough time to talk about all the different kind. You know, we had anybody from people in the garage buying stuff from Home Depot, gluing it together, coming in saying, I'm going to be the next best thing, to major car manufacturers and NASA. So, and they were all coming in simultaneously, needing our advice, needing our guidance. It was the most intense time of my professional career.
So, well, you know, I'm sure there's millions of people who need to thank you, and I'm sure that you got one from the top of the heap there from our president. But and let's move forward now, because I think all that lays the groundwork to the next part of the conversation, was like, how is this going to affect you in your role as the director of your division going forward? I will tell you that, I mean, at least from personal experience with portfolio companies and from the general, you know, I would say commentary that is shared with me during conversations in the business community, the FDA has become a much more pleasant place to interact over the last several years. And I think that the general feeling is that there is a maybe a, you know, more collaborative sense of engagement from the FDA, whereas in the past, you're right, it was more of a black box, people thinking how they were going to get shut down, to more, let's figure out how we can help you get through this process a little bit more quickly, right? So is that, do you think some of that's a result of the COVID crisis and your experiences there? Do you think that this is just the natural progression of the FDA? Kind of what is it, and what is your sense as to where the FDA is headed?
So I think it's twofold. I think, as I mentioned, you know, we started our collaborative efforts more than 10 years ago because I truly believe that the only way you can expedite innovation is to bring everybody into the same room, whether it's virtual or physical, and first identify what is the block, where is the block, and then figure out what needs to be done to solve the block, you know. And my favorite example is our work in the collaborative community on ophthalmic imaging. This is an organization that was started in 2019, and the goal is to consensus for ophthalmic AI and AI and machine learning devices around the globe. And what started on a shoestring, as Mark Blumenkratz likes to say, you know, has really grown because people have expressed the support and value. And our last meeting, we had 1,200 people signed up for our workshop from, I think it was 47 countries. We got all continents, yes. So I think communicating the fact that FDA does not believe that we can do this on our own, and trying to say, if you want advancement, if you want innovation, you too need to roll up your sleeves, come to the table, work with us, not against us, not, you know, don't block us, don't. If you want to get things done, we want to be part of the conversation. And I think that's something that we started long ago, but personally, having lived through COVID, it really does put a filter on to focus only on what's important. And I always try to challenge my team. I mean, while we need to address all the details, I always like to challenge my team not to forget the big picture. Is this device really going to help population in need? Is there a real advantage to getting this on the market? And then if yes, let's just figure out how to deal with the little details sometimes, not so little, but, you know, a lot of things can be overcome if people listen to our advice and move forward.
Right. And I think, you know, I think that's the message that's been passed down, and I think it's been relatively well received, which is that early engagement with the FDA is going to make you more efficient in utilizing your capital as you progress forward. It doesn't pay to go down a pathway that you haven't really, or even a novel pathway, where you haven't had some guidance from the regulatory agency, because they may look at it and say, this isn't going to work, and this is not something that's provable, or it's not going to be something that we would encourage that you do. So there's a, you know what you do? You need another workshop. You need another workshop where you can have, you know, people who are interested in product development say, here's what you should do, and in this order, in order to make your path a little bit smoother. Because a lot of people, and again, I'm giving you this from my personal experience, come to us with early opportunities, have not done that. They haven't had that kind of guidance at all. And I think the earlier you get involved with the FDA, if you're willing to hear those conversations and have those conversations, then they should be had at the earliest possible stage. So good for you for encouraging it.
Yeah, we always say it's never too early to come to us. As I alluded to, I've been at FDA a very long time, and one of the things I pride myself most is an incredible team that I have built up, especially in ophthalmics, because, you know, it was all of my hats as I kept changing. The ophthalmology has been under my supervision for a very long time. You know, neurology and neurosurgery came and went kind of. So I have incredible team with really true knowledge base that is incomparable. I mean, I have people who are considered the world experts. And what I like to make sure is the sponsors understand when they come to us to listen to the advice, because we have seen a lot of Titanics that sunk.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, due to the confidentiality rules, very often we can't tell you which Titanic it was that we're referring to. But if somebody comes in and is proposing XYZ, but asks us only about Z, I always encourage my team to give feedback on the aspects of X and Y that they're going to go down south fast. So very often we will give comments, and, you know, it's always helpful for sponsors to listen to them, because sometimes they might seem like they're coming out of left field. but it's really based on seeing all of those Titanics.
So message to anybody, if the FDA gives you comments, follow them. If they give you guidance, follow it. That's kind of the story there, right? For the entirety of my career as an ophthalmology investor and as somebody who's been involved in the, or at least has an interest in the propagation of novel technology into the clinical space, the face of the FDA for us in ophthalmology has been, Wiley and Malvina, right? Everybody knows Wiley and Malvina. Now, Wiley's recently, departed. So our comfort is going to be seeing Malvina up there with, Wiley's replacement, who we'll all have to get a feel for. But, just in closing comments, I will tell you that I think that everybody in the ophthalmology business world owes you a little bit of gratitude and a little bit of sense of thanks, because I think that the change in tone that has been palpable in the business community is directly related to some of the, mandates and processes that you've helped put in place. And I definitely think that it's led to a little bit of a renaissance in innovation. And just as I have come across, hundreds and hundreds of opportunities inside the ophthalmology space, I know that you have to be coming across those same hundreds and hundreds of opportunities in the ophthalmology space. I know the workload is probably daunting, but I can say that the path to success and approval has been clarified and expedited, and I think there's going to be continued advancement. And I think we should all, give you a big, thanks for having helped accomplish that.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm always open to any other suggestions on how we can work together to expedite innovation in ophthalmology.
Well, Malvina, thank you so much for taking the time today. This was great. I'm glad we got a chance to catch up. We're normally running by each other in some meeting all the time, saying hello, asking about each other's kids, and then moving on to whatever else is going on. But it's great to have been able to sit down with you and get some insight into your past, the path that led you here, your sort of goals for what the FDA is going to continue to do. And on behalf of everybody, again, thank you for all that you've done. And, hopefully we'll continue to have these, conversations once in a while as things change. I'm sure people like hearing it in a more relaxed setting while they're sitting at home or in their car or whatever. So thank you. And I'm looking forward to seeing you at the next meeting.
Look forward to participating and supporting OIS in any way I can.
Thanks, OIS audience. Hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Looking forward to speaking with you again soon.
Bye-bye.